You're listening to the Healthcare Goes Digital podcast. Get ready to be inspired as we explore provocative topics surrounding innovative technologies and ideas with top industry professionals as we help to positively disrupt healthcare. At Impetus Digital, we believe that everything starts with a thought as we aspire to act as the bridge to ignite these courageous conversations, both through our Insight platform and through these fireside chats. Let's get started with your host, Natalie Eden, Managing Director and co-owner of Impetus Digital, an all-in-one virtual collaboration solution for online meetings, events, and advisory boards.
Hi, everybody. My name is Natalie Eden, and I'm the co-founder and CEO with Impetus Digital. Impetus Digital builds some of the best-in-class asynchronous and synchronous virtual collaboration and communication tools for life science companies. And we've been catering and providing white glove service to these companies over the past 12 years across the globe to do everything from virtualizing advisory board meetings, medical education events, investigator sessions, internal hackathons and corporate events, and everything in between. But what's really important at Impetus is that we really believe that everything starts with a conversation. And with those conversations, we can amplify the message by using virtual touch points like Impetus to have ongoing, sustained, authentic partnerships so that we can all work to collectively and positively disrupt healthcare. So we're super excited about leveraging this podcast to be able to speak to some of these digital entrepreneurs, thought leaders, provocateurs in the healthcare space to ask these important questions. And then we're going to want to actually challenge us to be thinking, how else can we continue these really provocative conversations? So I'm really excited to have one of these thought leaders. This is Laura Towart. She's the founder and CEO of a company called My Personal Therapeutics. She founded this to advance a groundbreaking personalized approach to cancer that was developed at Mount Sinai Medical Center. Laura is also the founder and former CEO of a company called Cellmatix. And this was a company that was a leader in genomics and pharma-targeted generation of women's health. Laura became really passionate about personal medicine during her PhD studies at the Weill Cornell Graduate School for Medical Sciences, basically at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. She then since has been very actively involved in translational advances in medicine. So welcome, Laura. So happy to have you on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
What an inspiring trajectory, if you will. And now that we hear a lot more about women coming into STEM, getting into science, medicine, you know, technology, tell us a little bit about the trajectory. Did you always know you wanted to get into medicine? And how on earth did you end up founding not one, but two companies?
Well, so I always knew that I was interested in medicine and actually really science. And so I knew that that was going to be my path from, you know, as a young child. As my career and my studies progressed, I became more and more entrepreneurial and thinking about things from a commercial perspective. I was always entrepreneurial, but then when I went to grad school at Cornell, I really started getting kind of looped into the network in New York City. So you have so many different, you know, avenues in New York with financial, and it's like really the intersection of the universe. And so I was a founding member of a club at Cornell called the Club Biomed, which was an investment club. And then I took advantage of some of the other programs that the city had to offer, like at the New York Academy of Sciences. They had a course called From Idea to IPO. And after I took that course, I really became completely laser focused on looking to see which technologies that I was seeing in the laboratory or hearing about from classmates that could be potentially commercialized and brought to market.
That is phenomenal. And so before, you know, we're going to spend a lot of time talking about my personal therapeutics company, but before that, you founded a company called Cellmatix.
Cellmatix.
Sorry, what was that?
We call it Cellmatix.
Cellmatic, sorry, pronounced it incorrectly. So Cellmatic. So tell us a little bit about what that company was, what it was doing, and why you decided to leave that to start My Personal Therapeutics.
Sure. So, well, I started Cellmatic. Actually, I left my PhD studies to start Cellmatic with one of my roommates from Cornell. And so Cellmatic grew out of conversations with Puri Abhay, my old roommate. And we were thinking, we were young women, and we were thinking about starting our own families. And we were becoming increasingly conscious of female fertility and infertility, and wanted to contribute to the understanding of the fertilome, which is a term that we coined, which really means the fertility-related genes of the genome. And we wanted to see that if we actually, you know, could identify which genes and mutations were underlying different reproductive issues like infertility or that led to infertility, how can this translate to more evidence-based decision-making for fertility treatments? And so we started the company about 2008, and I was the founding CEO and was with the company for some time. But then actually my life took a turn. I moved with my family to the Middle East, and I became kind of less and less attached to the day-to-day business of Cellmatic, just by nature of being so far and the company growing so quickly. So Puri actually took over as CEO, and I took a position on the board and kind of looked at the company from, from a board perspective rather as an employee. And then during that time, I was introduced to Mount Sinai and this technology that now seeds My Personal Therapeutics. And then I started to become more and more involved. And I've been involved with the technology and with the inventor of the technology at Mount Sinai for about a decade. So this company has been a long time in the making.
It is really a beautiful process. And I'm going to walk through for the audience listening to each of the really incredible steps that your company takes through what you're calling the personal discovery process. And I absolutely love it. It's really the epitome, in my opinion, of precision medicine. You can't get more precise than this. So let's actually get started. So with this personal discovery process, this all starts with getting the right tumor biopsy. Tell us a little bit about what is the premise and the context around proper excision, getting the right biopsies, because we hear all kinds of horror stories about it's not the right thing and has to be redone, or it's done redundantly and all these sorts of things. So tell us a little bit around tumor biopsies, how it's done properly, and how to manage the quality assurance of the biopsies that are received.
Sure. Actually, we haven't had a lot of issues with any of the biopsies that we've received from patients and their oncologists. So we don't have a lot of restrictions on on the biopsy procedure. So really, a standard biopsy, either fresh frozen or formalin fixed paraffin embedded on slides, is fine for starting our personal discovery process. So so on that side of the process, it's quite straightforward.
Right. So once people have signed up and they want to go through this process and the tumor biopsy is sent to the company, you go through your rigor with the algorithm and with the very specific system that you have created, where you're doing a patient exome to analyze and to capture the tumor network. So can you explain to everybody what a patient exome is and what exactly are you analyzing?
Sure. So once we have the patient's biopsy, which can be either ordered at the time that the patient decides that they want to start the personal discovery process, or it can be a biopsy that they've had in the past year, up to 2 years, depending on the tumor type. So they would send the biopsy to our partner sequencing facility for whole exome sequencing. And so we need a biopsy sample and also a blood sample, and we do whole exome sequencing on both. And we do very deep sequencing of the tumor. So we do a whole exome sequence at 300x at least. And so this is so we can resolve all of the subclones and get a very representative view of which mutations are leading tumorigenesis. And so then we do a very deep analysis or interrogation of the tumor exome, and we identify what we believe are up to 20 of the leading mutations. And so this can be known oncogenes, but it could also be genes that are involved or mutations that are involved in the tumorigenic process that might not be picked up on something like a panel test, like a Foundation One test or others like that. And so then our method is unique because we can select up to 20 mutations or alterations, really, and recreate these mutations in fruit flies. So recreating the entire tumor network, so that the fruit fly will develop a tumor that's genetically similar to the patient's tumor and can be used as an avatar. And then we grow up to 500,000 of these avatars for each patient, which enables us to then do high throughput drug screening using all approved drugs, FDA or EMA or wherever the patient is, using that approved drug library. And we screen all of the drugs alone and then in combination to develop and resolve the best drug combination for that patient. So we see which combinations actually rescue the flies, because all of the flies will have a lethal tumor. And so only the flies that are getting the appropriate drug combination will survive.
Wow, that is amazing. A lot of people have heard probably in science classes of the use of, you know, the Drosophila, you know, the fruit fly, you know, but maybe you can kind of explain, why was the fruit fly chosen to be what you're calling to do this kind of amplification and understanding? So why specifically the fruit fly?
So the fruit fly is used, one, because, so we know, we've been using the fly for over a century in, you know, genetic studies, and most of the oncogenic, most of the oncogenes and oncogenic processes were first identified and named in the flies. So we know that that there's a high conservation of oncogenes and networks from fly to human. And then the fly is also, because it's been used in genetic studies for so long, we've really learned how to manipulate the fly genome and through genetic engineering, be able to introduce so many mutations into the fly at one time. So for a mouse, you could engineer, you know, maybe a handful of mutations. That would take many years. And so it's very difficult to be able to reflect the true tumorigenic network and the true complexity in another, you know, in another animal. And so the fly also being able to quickly introduce a lot of mutations and then to be able to grow such a large number. So we screen about 500,000 flies for each patient. So to be able to generate that body of flies so quickly and then have such a large number to do such drug screening campaigns.
Lovely. And you have used, or we hear a lot in the technological world that we live in, especially since it's been revolutionized because of COVID-19. I think there's been a huge acceleration adoption over the past year. We hear a lot about the so-called virtual avatar, the digital avatar that all of us exists on the internet, sort of the footprint that we leave with all of the posts that we put on social media and the comments we leave to other people's areas, et cetera. So there's this digital avatar. So can you speak a little bit to this concept of the biological avatar or the biological twin? Should this be something that people should be afraid of? What does this look like?
So it's interesting. So we hear and use that the term, you know, biological twin or digital twin or avatar, and very in many different ways, and they mean different things in different audiences. So for example, companies that are doing purely computational predictions of treatment outcome are creating what they would call a digital twin of the patient. So they would take the patient's tumor network and then computationally see which would be the, you know, the appropriate recommendation. And we believe that, I mean, that could be quite predictive to a certain level, but what we're able to do is create an actual biological twin and then do experiments actually, not just, you know, using predictive modeling. So, but it's interesting because we can benefit from both. So what we're creating every time we do an experiment, we're generating such a large body of data. So we're taking, you know, up to 20 mutations and then we're engineering them to the fly and then we're screening. There's 2,100 around FDA approved drugs and we're screening those alone and in combination. So we're screening tens of thousands of drug combinations against a highly personalized model. So with each experiment, we have so much data that we generate that all feeds into our own computational model that can help us make better predictions in the future. computational-based predictions, but all of our predictions will be based on biological data that we've collected previously.
So this is just fascinating stuff. So what you're really saying is you've got these flies that are acting like biological avatars for a patient, and you're basically, if you will, dripping these FDA-approved drugs into these flies, you know, each and every one that's been approved, and then you're using smart algorithms, machine learning, to do predictions and also to determine what the best cocktails or mixtures or combinations would work precisely for that patient's chemistry, biology, tumor situation. Tell us a little bit about, obviously this is proprietary, but that smart algorithm piece. So not only is it specific to the patient, but is that process of elimination or building also leveraging the biological systems of previous patients who've undergone similar testing, bring that smart algorithm into the equation and then build on top of that?
Yes, and that's exactly how it works. So all of the historical treatment data feeds into the model and helps us make better predictions. So with each patient, our model actually gets stronger and more predictive. And so that's exactly how we're building it today.
Like, it still blows my mind that that's how new treatment recommendations at an N equals one level, like let alone the sort of population way that we do clinical studies. So with that said, how would you summarize is how the final cocktail is ascertained? What exactly are you looking for in terms of a reaction from the flies over what time? Basically, what are sort of the outcomes or the endpoints that you're analyzing?
So we really just look at survival at this point. So in the future, it might become, we might integrate other aspects. So we start with a lethality screen and we look to see the percentage of survival, like so the percentage of rescue. And so as all of the flies will pass away or will die, we look to see which combinations have the highest percent of survival. And so we provide to oncologists and to patients is a ranking of the top combinations. And so, which is one of the advantages of the technology is that it usually identifies more than one combination that looks successful, looks like it would be useful for the patient as a treatment recommendation. So we provide all of those in an order. And then we usually share these with the oncologist, who would share it with the tumor board at the hospital. And they would discuss which combination is best for the treatment, given not only our feedback, but the patient's like entire medical history. So, for example, one of the drugs in the combination could be a hypertension drug, which has come up in one of the screens before. And a patient, if they have cardiac issues, it might not be the best combination. It could also be that one of the drugs might be much more expensive than one of the others, so they might make that decision based on economics. Or it could be, let's say we have a patient in a country that doesn't have access to that particular drug in the combination, they might choose a different one. So there's a lot of reasons, but it is exciting that we're able to provide more than one recommendation, more than one combination.
Absolutely, Laura. Now, it's kind of interesting when we talk about the etiology or the natural history of a cancer, depending also if it's chronic or long-term, if it might be a CLL or something else versus something that immediately impacts a patient's life. And so there's an evolution of what happens with that tumor, just like we've seen with the vaccines and with the viruses, there can be mutations. So a cancer of what we captured today with the fruit flies could be something that looks completely different in 5 years. If the cancer, for example, metastasizes from one organ to another, does the patient have to go through a brand new set of analyses because it basically is a brand new cancer?
So that's a really good question. So this was studied over years at Mount Sinai before we licensed the technology. And what they've, because we're doing deeper sequencing of the tumor, so we're able to resolve the different subclones. And so over time, there might be different leaders in the tumor network. So, one mutation would overtake another, but the actual body of mutations, like the leading mutations, won't change. It just the relative kind of importance of one or the other in leading the tumor process might change. So that's what we've noticed so far, but that is something that we're going to be tracking as a company. So far, I mean, we're very early on and with the clinical data that we have, so it's something that we'll continue to collect over time. But it appears that the tumor network itself doesn't change vastly, you know, unless the patient has something like microsatellite instability, and in which, you know, then they're, you know, constantly developing new mutations. And so patients with that are MSI high are not candidates for our process.
Fantastic. Currently, with people who get diagnosed with a cancer, the process for doing all of this analysis, et cetera, is a bit reactive, which is still fine because this is an important thing to do. What most people are doing currently is we're starting to excavate the whole precision medicine, the use of diagnostics, nowadays even liquid biopsies and other sorts of things to determine mutations and other irregularities so that drugs can be a little bit more precisely administered. So if you were to compare to some of the standard tests, I'm thinking about something like EGFR testing for certain cancers and other types of mutation reviews and analyses and studies that we're currently using, how would you compare this to what you're doing?
So the standard of care is targeted chemotherapy, where you identify in a single mutation like, you know, KRAS, and then you drug that target. And really what we've seen in the clinic is that, you know, that's not very successful long-term, and that, you know, quickly patients will develop resistance, and they're developing resistance because the whole tumor network itself is not attacked, only one mutation. And so that's really the foundation of the company, is that we really have to address the complexity of human tumors and be able to create real models that enable us to look at these tumors not in a dish, but in a, you know, represent them 3D in a living animal, because we know that tumors don't behave like tumors in a dish. Tumors interact with, you know, the vascular system, the nervous system, you know, so we really need to be able to truly represent them. And that's how, you know, that's really the driving force of the company, is to really capture that network and figure out how to drug it.
So if somebody is interested in doing this procedure, tell us what the duration is from beginning to getting the results or the cocktail recommendation.
Sure. So when the patient first enrolls, they would have their tumor biopsy sent for sequencing. So that takes about 4 weeks at the best partner that we have. About a week after that, we provide the patient with what we call a sequencing report. So it's a custom report that can help direct the patient's early treatment. So it's just one step personalized, but not the full personal discovery process. So the patient can begin on, you know, a treatment that's guided by the sequencing report. And then that's when we start really our, you know, creating the avatars and doing the drug screening. And then it takes about, it's taking about 5 to 6 months from that point for us to get the patient a treatment recommendation. And it's something that we're working to try to speed up. And as we have more and more patients to feed into the model, we'll be able to offer something called AI-PDP, or machine learning or predictive modeling driven personal discovery process, where we can go immediately from a patient's whole exome to a treatment recommendation. And that's something that we're really working to build and is a goal for this year. So, but in the meantime, it is taking, you know, about 6 months for each patient.
So this is really interesting, because I was mentioning that these diagnostics that are currently in play, and again, a lot of the issue has to do from the time of biopsy to some sort of a result, you know, KRAS, EGFR, HER2, whatever the tag or the mutation, so that the appropriate product, biologic, whatever, is actually appropriately administered. And the pressure is always on around timing, because again, timing is of the essence, especially for cancer patients. I know that a lot of what you're targeting right now are things like GI, lung, rare cancers. And so there's a timing issue. It does make one ask the question, instead of waiting for an actual cancer diagnosis, is the route in the future looking, because, you know, again, we're looking at, you know, companies like 23andMe, whole genome testing, is this going to be potentially part of somebody's healthcare policy or a way that people just manage health in general in the future, where they get exome testing or genome testing? It's kind of banked. And maybe that would be a way to sort of accelerate some of this foundational work that you're doing.
Yes, I mean, I think more and more, you know, we're looking at preventative medicine and trying to understand, you know, identify, you know, biomarkers that, you know, that we can kind of pinpoint towards having, you know, increased likelihood of getting different cancers. But it's, you can't really, until you have a tumor, it's difficult to really understand how to treat it. And it's, I think the detection is kind of a different story.
Yeah, for sure. So I guess the exome testing, either, you know, proactive or not, it still doesn't help to accelerate that back end piece, which is really what you're doing with the flies and using all of the approved drugs, which are going to continue to change in the future. And so that piece needs to be compressed somehow, like you said, over time as you gain more and more data.
Yes. Yeah, so just to clarify. So when we do the exome testing, so we have to test the tumor exome as well as the, you know, the patient's baseline blood exome. And so, and without having the, you know, the tumor piece, then there's, you know, there's not a lot of benefit.
Yeah, I totally get it. That makes sense. Thanks for the clarification. It seems like a fairly long process. Obviously, if one has the ability to wait for it, it seems like it would probably be able to pay in dividends from a health standpoint. But ultimately, who pays for this? It sounds like it would be an expensive venture. What does that look like?
So right now we're only offering the test privately, and we charge $15,000 for each personal discovery process, and that includes the whole exome sequencing of the tumor and the blood. In time, as we develop our AI integrated product, that's something that we will look to go through the regulatory process in the U.S. as a, you know, laboratory developed test, and, you know, get registered as an in vitro diagnostic in UK and Europe. And then we would apply for reimbursement so that we can seek integration into the healthcare system. But that's something that will take, you know, a number of years.
So would it be fair to say that your company is still using this technology in an exploratory way? Is it technically part of clinical trials right now?
So there are a few ongoing clinical trials and studies, but we offer the personal discovery process commercially as well. And we're able to offer it without any kind of regulatory clearance because it's used as a decision support tool for oncologists. So it's not something that, you know, we're not diagnosing anything. We're just being able to provide more information about, you know, the patient's, you know, tumor exome, and then, you know, factual information about the drug screening data that we identify. And so we do have a number of clinical trials though ongoing. There was a trial started at 2015 at Mount Sinai. This is an N-of-1 trial, mainly of patients with colorectal cancer, also medullary thyroid carcinoma, and some other rare head and neck cancers. So there were 23 patients enrolled. So far, 9 patients have been treated. And it's one of the conditions for the trial, one of the preconditions, is that patients have to fail every other treatment option first. And so some of the other patients in the trial are still having success on other, you know, other treatments. So at the point of which they fail others, then they would get their personalized recommendation. And so far, 2 case studies have been published from the trial. Both patients had, you know, what we would characterize as kind of wild success. And more data will be coming out of the clinical trial as it continues. We've started as a company a clinical study, and this is on GI cancer in the UK. So it was funded by Innovate UK. And it will give us a lot of important outcomes data within the NHS setting and also health economics data. And then we have a number of other studies going on in the world, one in Saudi Arabia for colorectal cancer, and we're starting a study with partners in Switzerland as well.
So what is exactly the study looking at? Is it comparing it to the standard diagnostics that are being used, and then to ascertain the differences in the final endpoints or the outcome improvements? Tell us a little bit about what you're using as the standard of care.
So So it is difficult because it's not a matched trial. So it's really an N of one study. And so what we're looking at with each patient that gets treated is their number of months of progression-free survival. We're looking at things like tumor shrinkage and also different tumor marker levels. And so we want to see, which percent have a response. So with the trial at Mount Sinai, the patients that would be allowed to do the to receive the personal discovery process, they would have had a 0% response rate to the prior treatment. And so we were then looking at having some improvement over no response.
Yeah, and those are some of the toughest patients to get any response. So if you can get a response in those patients, you must be doing really well.
In the patients that we have data for, we have about a 33% response in patients that had zero response. So it is quite outstanding.
It really is. And so the question also comes down to is, are you looking at things like toxicity levels? If you are looking appropriately, I know that really what you were using is it was survival with the flies, but are you noticing anything around levels of toxicity or side effects?
Yes, I'm glad you asked. So the fly is actually a great model for studying toxicity of drugs, because if something is toxic to a human in a combination, it's going to be very toxic to a fly and the fly won't survive. So we use the flies for toxicity screening of different drugs. But what we've noticed in the patient combinations, so in all of the combinations that have been generated so far, they're combinations of, with one chemotherapeutic agent and one or more non-chemotherapeutic agents. It could be things like I said, hypertension medicine, and anemia medicine, asthma medicine. And so those other drugs wouldn't have high toxicity profile. So the overall combination is less toxic. So as an example, the recent case study that was published, the patient, when he was on his personalized combination, had such an improved quality of life, his health-related quality of life, that he was able to go back to the gym, was going to work, lived a very active and reported having, a much easier time. And so that's something that we share with patients, and that's really exciting.
Absolutely. When you end up predicting or forecasting a specific drug cocktail, one would automatically assume, oh, wow, this is going to be expensive. Has anybody done the cost utility evaluation of the full picture of the cost versus the other ramifications and really kind of getting an affordability piece to this? What does that look like?
Yeah, so it looks that we've actually done a very rough study, but it's something that we're doing now. We're going through all of the data from Mount Sinai from the clinical trial, and we're doing a proper health economic analysis to look at which combinations and which therapies the patient was on before, and the response rate and the cost versus the cost of the personalized treatment, factoring in the cost of the process. And so far, it's looking it's without doing the calculations, you can see that there's a lot of course cost savings because the combinations are much cheaper. We're also, one of the limitations of our technology is that we're not able to screen biologics because we're working with fruit flies. And so the combinations are usually combinations of drugs that, are approved, and some might be generic. So it's overall, the combinations are much cheaper.
Wow. Really, really interesting to see what that looks like. So fascinating. So what does this mean, or what could this mean for people like the payers, insurance companies, employers? What does that longer term forecast look like, and why should it matter to them?
Well, it should matter to them because there's the system right now, we're spending so much money on, testing, it's basically testing therapies on patients, going through trial and error. And this eliminates that. We can go immediately to the treatments that work, and that benefits, patients, payers, society, in a very large way, and it will have a huge impact. And so we're just starting to, do those calculations and share them with, with payers. We're still early on as a company in that process, but as we generate more data, I think that argument is going to be very strong.
Absolutely. It's going to be very, very tantalizing to sort of examine that. And I think that there's also potentially some huge ramifications for pharmaceutical companies. So first and foremost, is this a methodology that pharma companies can use as a way to profile themselves competitively against other drugs?
Yes, exactly. So I didn't mention at the start, but we've just changed our name of the company. So we're going from My Personal Therapeutics to the new company name is Vivan Therapeutics. And we've decided to change the name because we're about to announce that we've expanded our license with Mount Sinai and that we're now able to use the platform for drug discovery and development and co-development with pharma. And so we wanted to seem less kind of consumer genomics focused by, you know, having, you know, My Personal in the name, and really establish ourselves as a partner for pharma and a partner for biopharma. And it's really exciting because not only can we offer, you know, patients something immediately, which is, you know, combinations of approved drugs, but we can really play a large role in the development of different new therapeutic programs. And we can help pharma identify, you know, which early stage drugs they'd like to move forward in their pipeline based on, you know, different response rates and different fruit fly avatars.
Wow. It just kind of blows your mind to think about what the possibilities are. I mean, obviously machine learning is a huge part of drug discovery, but now kind of adding this extra dimension, there's a lot of really neat things that can probably transpire, including allowing companies to get an early take on their patient avatar. So the whole patient stratification piece and also doing a little bit of that early work around biomarker discovery. Are these the sorts of questions that you're trying to help pharma companies figure out at the early stages?
Yes, exactly. And one of the things that we can do is kind of virtual clinical trials. So if pharma has, you know, let's say a patient population that they're thinking of enrolling, they can send us the whole exome sequence of the patient's tumor. We can build a matched avatar, and then they can share also their investigational drug, and we can tell them whether that drug will be effective in that patient based on the avatar response. And similarly, we have for each of the avatars that we've ever created, we keep those fly lines alive. And so we have what we call the flybrary. So it's a library of flies. And yeah, but we can share that with pharma, and they can say, okay, I want to test my drug in this, or I want to test my drug in this versus my competitor's drug, and because I want to do a matched comparison, or right. I want to see if you could screen my drug with the FDA approved drug library to see if there's, you know, a better partner for my drug, and then also maybe test it in different fruit flies. So let's say that it's a colorectal cancer drug, maybe in combination with another drug, it works for prostate cancer or for another cancer that we can build an avatar for. So it is really exciting, and that's something that we're really thrilled to bring to the pharma development.
So this is really neat because we're hearing a lot of this sort of sci-fi stuff when we talk about clinical trials in situ, but this is kind of a way of doing preliminary work before it ever hits humans. And so there's an accelerated approach of competitive differentiation and the client avatar. And so the speed at which we're probably going to be able to discover new chemical and biological entities is going to be mind-boggling. So I am kind of curious, in the oncology treatment landscape, how can companies start thinking about CAR-T and CRISPR, and how does this relate to what you can bring to the table?
So I would say for CAR-T therapy, we wouldn't see it as competitive because that's really looking at the world of immunotherapy. And so we don't really work with cancers that have a lot of success with immunotherapy. And so we differentiate ourselves that way. And then with CRISPR, it's actually, we don't generate the flies using CRISPR now, but eventually, you know, it's something that we're looking to potentially accelerate our model building is incorporating CRISPR. And that's something that the inventor of the technology has had some experience with. It makes us a little bit concerned because we don't want it to kind of change the process now, because we don't know down the line what other effects CRISPR might have, that we don't want to introduce anything that might give us a not a true result that later in the line, down the line, we say, oh, you know, that was a misstep. And so we know that the way that we're integrating the mutations into the genome, creating the transgenic flies now, is kind of, it's tried and true. So a CRISPR could be a nice shortcut, but it might also introduce issues.
Absolutely love it, Laura. What an absolutely innovative, exciting company. Congratulations on the new collaboration with Mount Sinai and all of the things to come. I am certainly going to be enjoying watching on the sidelines. It's some very cool things. We invite any companies who are interested, who are watching and listening. We will be sharing Laura's contact information and her company in case you're interested in doing any of this work, any of this partnership. This sounds absolutely astronomical, wonderful, and I'm super stoked about it. For those of you who are also interested, check out impetusdigital.com for these kinds of conversations. How are you going to plan clinical trial, discovery, new protocols, new thinking, going beyond the pill? This is what we do at Impetus. We have these asynchronous virtual collaboration touch points with your key stakeholders, patients, physicians, allied healthcare providers, and payers, all coming together virtually to figure this stuff out. So we would love to hear from you. So please check it out. Like and subscribe to our channel so you can, others can find our information. We want to thank everybody for your time. Thank you, Laura, for a great conversation. And we wish everybody a fantastic day ahead.
Thank you for listening to this Healthcare Goes Digital podcast. Impetus Digital are the business-to-business advisory board experts and provide virtual collaboration solutions for meetings, events, and projects worldwide. Visit us at impetusdigital.com to find out more and subscribe to our LinkedIn, Twitter, and YouTube to stay up to date about other upcoming inspiring conversations.